Come right in, pull up a chair. It's time once again to gather around the gaming table with your friends at The Gaming Game. This time around, Jeff and Elliot will be tackling Chaos Isle from Real Masters Game Forge, Sid Meier's Civilization the Board Game from Fantasy Flight Games, and The Spanish Civil War from GMT. And we'll talk about the latest in gaming news on this episode of The Gaming Game. Now here are your hosts, Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller.
What? What do you want?
Can't you see I'm busy?
I'm busy here. I'm Jeff McAleer.
And I am Elliot Miller.
Thanks for joining us again. And we're here to bring you another heaping helping of red-hot gaming news and some of our reviews of games that we've played lately. Should we move on to the gaming news right away, Mr. Elliot?
Let's get right into it.
What do you got?
Fantasy Flight has announced a new expansion for Arkham
Horror. How excited were you about that?
I was pretty excited, I have to admit. This one's coming out in spring 2011, so we should be seeing it in the next few months. It's called Miskatonic University. This expansion is going to be a little different than their previous expansions because it adds cards to other expansions. So it's like an expansion. It comes with 450 new cards. It adds new mythos and location cards for Dunwich, for Kingsport, and for Innsmouth, as well as new cards for Gates, Epic Battles, Relationships, Injuries, Madness, Skills, Blights. There's new material for every Arkham Horror expansion in this game.
The list goes on and on.
It goes on and on. And this is the first time they've done it. This is the first time that they've actually expanded some of the previous expansions. And some of those expansions are a lot of fun. I'm pretty hyped about it.
I was going to say, as someone who does not have Arkham Horror, like me, I'm going to get it. I've had some outlays of cash lately with a new car and repairing another vehicle and all this other stuff. What I was going to ask is, as far as this new expansion, coming from someone who does not have the game as of yet, and will no doubt pick up the expansions and things like that, this expansion almost makes me feel like if you want all this goodness, you have to go buy all these expansions.
Well, it would be helpful, since it'd be pretty hard for you to use the cards for expansions that you don't actually have.
Right.
So if you only have the base game, I don't see a point in getting the game. But I don't think the game
expansion
was developed.
Just said if you don't have the game, I don't see it, you know, there being any points in getting the game.
No, you definitely should have the game.
If you don't own it, don't bother getting on board now. You're a loser.
Loser. But it adds cards to all the other expansions, which is cool for us, those of us who are completists and have gone and gotten every expansion that there is because we really enjoy playing the game. Mm-hmm. But for somebody who is just going to start by picking up Arkham Horror, you'd be better served going out and buying one of the big box expansions the first time you want to get an expansion. I mean, you can play the base game, you know.
Of course, right.
A lot of times without having to get any expansion, and it's still a lot of fun. But they add things in the expansions that add a lot more depth to the game and give new boards. So that's why it takes up like two tables to play one game. Mm-hmm. Playing with all the expansions is pretty much impossible.
Oh, that's like all-day, all-night experience, isn't it?
Right. It would be more trouble than it would actually be worth because you would spend as much time setting the game up as you would be playing.
Right. Well, if I may ask.
Oh, they have that new app.
Yes, I know. We did mention that they have a new iPhone and iPad app, bunch of tools for the game. For someone who gets Arkham Horror, and I'm probably picking it up sometime, maybe this week or next, all depends. I kept trying to buy it, but it was out of stock.
Really? Well, it's a good game. They're actually got a new print coming out very soon. So
I thought it's already.
It should be
available
everywhere.
I try to support the local game stores. Well, the one.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
Welcome to Arizona.
Yeah. Well, no, I didn't. Yeah, we talked about last show the kind of bizarre game stores that are out here. What I was going to ask though is, what one expansion would you really recommend? Or are the expansions set up for Arkham Horror where the first expansion that came out, and I don't know what it was, the King in Yellow or Dunwich or whatever, I don't know. Do you have to have all the different expansions before you pick up the next expansion? Or could I go out and say, ooh, you know, Elliot said that this expansion's really good. I should go get that too.
I would say that you could buy any expansion you want. You know, they have the big box expansions, and which would be Dunwich, Kingsport, and Innsmouth. And then they have the smaller box expansions, which are the other ones.
Is it Dunwich or
King
Dunwich?
And Yellow. It's probably Dunwich, but I was listening to, you know, that podcast.
Right, the one that you were a guest on?
H.P. Lovecraft one. Yeah,
right.
And they were up in the air whether it's Dunwich or Dunwich 2. They had a debate on it, so I don't know which one it is.
Okay.
Americanized, it's probably Dunwich.
I would think. And it is, it's supposed to be a town in
America.
It's
supposed to be an American town. Exactly. So the big box ones have a lot more depth in them, and they add the new boards. So, you know, you're getting, they're more expensive, but you're getting a lot out of them. So once you've had your fill of the base game, I've enjoyed Innsmouth the most out of the big box expansions.
Okay.
You can slowly turn into one of the Innsmouth
folk
creatures. Yeah. You get the Innsmouth look.
Which you've had for years.
Funny. Right. With a wide mouth and his reptilian face.
How's that flakiness around your neck doing?
You know, it's itching right now. I don't know. Dunwich is also pretty cool because at a certain point in the game, the Dunwich horror can come out. And then they also introduce things like heralds, which you don't get in the base game.
Do you get Maud?
Which is another evil guy. No, you don't get Maud. I believe that's in the next expansion after this one.
Yes, there's another reference thrown out that 90% of our listeners won't catch. But anyway.
And then there's Maud.
No, Harold and Maud.
Actually, it's Harold and Maud.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. 90% of our listeners and my co-host won't get.
And 50% of the hosts. But some of the smaller expansions add some cool stuff, too. Like you get relationship cards in Lurker at the Threshold, which was one of the most recent expansions. I think it was the last one out.
I think that was the last
one. And so you can have relationships, you know.
With the monsters?
No, with the monsters. Ah, my flowers.
Well, that's how you became one of the Innsmouth folk.
Innsmouth folk. I would say a big box expansion would be one of your best bets for your first expansion.
Okay.
The smaller ones add cool stuff, too. The King in Yellow, it's actually a touring play company that comes into town to put on this play, The King in Yellow. So it adds a lot of little cool play related things. And, you know, you can, The King in Yellow can come out. And all of them add new creatures and new ancient ones and new characters. So there's like 64 characters available now.
But we know your tried and true favorite is Ashcan Pete.
It is, because he's got the dog. I like the dog.
See, what's funny is, you know, I've never played the game. Well, I take that. No, that's right. I never have played the game now that I think about it, except when it was the old, old version from Chaosium.
Yeah, which I still have.
Which you still have, right?
Which was also cool.
I find it funny that I can remember stuff about this game having never played it.
Well, you're like a mutant or something.
I am. Know.
I can't remember a game that I played yesterday.
I'm one of the Dunwich folk.
Dunwich?
Yeah, right. What else is included in the new expansion, Miskatonic Universe?
The game, it's got new skill, gate, and mythos cards for the base game. So it does have additional stuff for the base game. It's got additional exhibit item cards for Curse of the Pharaoh, Curse of the Dark Pharaoh, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
It's got new injury, madness, Dunwich location, and Dunwich horror cards for Dunwich horror. And just to say, the madness cards, those are cool. I try to play them even if I'm not playing the Dunwich expansion.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also recommended to me by Richard Linnaeus when we played. He says he always uses the madness card because instead of being killed, you pick up a madness card and you end up with a certain kind of phobia, which is really neat and adds a lot to playing your character, you know. It also comes with an all-new Dunwich Horror Herald sheet. More Blight and Act cards for the King in Yellow, new Kingsport location, Epic Battle, Blessings of Noden, and Visions of Hypnos cards for Kingsport Horror, 20 new Cult Encounter cards for Black Go to the Woods, new Innsmouth location and Innsmouth look cards for Innsmouth Horror, additional relationship cards and reckoning cards for Lurker at the Threshold. Plus, it comes with some player reference sheet and a new institution variant. I like the fact that it's adding these player reference sheets because it helps you keep track of different setups based on the number of players you have. Mm-hmm. So it'll say right in front of you how many gates can be open before, you know, you lose the game, what the monster limit is, depending on how many players are playing, and how many monsters appear when a gate opens. And it's all based on the number of, well, not number of players, but number of investigators that are playing the game.
Right.
So that's going to be pretty cool, because otherwise, you know, I could never remember it. We'd have to look it up in the rule book every time. Like, oh, no, we got a gate burst coming here. And then there's a new variant called the Institution variant. So there's a lot of stuff packed into this expansion. I'm really looking forward to it. Cool. Spring 2011.
Lock and Load Publishing has announced War Party. And it's a fantasy board game that mixes elements of strategy with elements of role-playing. And it's now part of their pre-order on their website. In War Party, players take command of the heroes and armies in a fantasy world beset by conflict, unlike any other fantasy world. I guess we
beset
should...
Beset by love.
Yeah, and peace and happiness. I'd love to see a fantasy series where there's no evil
right.
empire.
Nothing happens.
Yeah, exactly. An alliance of dwarves and men are pitted in a battle of survival against the evil hordes of goblins and their nefarious undead. To win, players recruit massive armies, build cities, develop technology, and conquer territory in an effort to defeat their opponents by ultimately capturing their homeland. Beyond the mere battling of armies and world conquest, players direct the development of heroes to explore dungeons, battle fierce creatures, and gain valuable treasure and spells that can be used to turn the tides of war against their foes. War Party allows challenges and immersion for new players as well as seasoned veterans, offering the possibility for many different strategic avenues for players to master. Each army is compiled of many unique units that offer each army not only its own flavor, but its own diverse set of strategies. I wasn't reading that from the Lock and Load press release, now was I?
Lock and Load.
I was taking a look at some of the pre-production information on the Lock and Load website. It looks like this could be a pretty neat game. I haven't played any Lock and Load games.
No, neither have I.
Mark Walker is the owner, and we've kind of emailed back and forth a bit. And looking at their website, and they've got quite a few games, and they do quite a few war games, but they also do quite a few zombie games and things like that. They look pretty interesting. I'm looking forward to trying to get my hands on some Lock and Load publishing titles so we can do some reviews and check them out.
Excellent.
Yes.
I would like to see that too.
It's either All Things Zombies or All Things Zombie. Looks like that's pretty cool.
Yeah, you know, zombies are big.
That's right.
I gotta admit, I'm on the zombie bandwagon.
The Walking Dead.
Yeah, that's true. Too bad the next show won't be out for another year, but...
Well, it'll be fall. You still have the comic.
Yeah, okay. Well, I don't want to read the comic now, because...
The comic and the show diverged.
Yes, they did.
So
I read at least that far. So Steve Jackson Games has decided to re-release some of their older games, which is pretty cool. Now, you may remember some of these games because I believe you played some of them.
I know where you're going.
The Awful Green Things from Outer Space.
Yep, Tom Wham.
Is being re-released. Yes, as well as Give Me the Brain, which I don't remember Give Me the Brain.
I don't remember that either.
And Lord of the Fries, which...
I don't recall that one.
I don't remember that one either, to tell you the truth. These are all older Steve Jackson games that they're going to be re-released with new modern components and, you know, great color, so... They won't be the little $5 ones. They'll now be probably $25.
Well,
or thereabouts.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but The Awful Green Things from Space, that was a TSR game.
It actually was originally released in Dragon Magazine.
That's right.
In 1980.
And yeah. it was released by TSR.
Yeah.
As a box
eventually
game.
Was published by Steve Jackson. And now they're going to be republishing it.
Are you
in
sure?
This wacky two-player game, one player controls the awful green things, and the other player is not the awful green things. They grow and multiply every turn, especially if they can gobble up a crew member. The other player commands the crew, frantically trying to weapon after weapon, pool sticks, fire extinguishers, can of zworts, to find something that kills the monsters.
This pool sticks are good.
You think so?
I've used it to kill many nothing.
Awful green thing. This includes the outside the Znutar. Nutar? Znutar.
Don't ask me.
Includes the outside the Nutar rules and counters for going out of the airlocks and fighting on the surface of the ship. And upgraded components, of course. A mounted game board, heavy cut die counters, and a full color rule book. That's in Awful Green Things.
I'm telling you, I don't think Steve Jackson Games ever published that.
Well, it's nice of them to re-release it then.
The reason why I mention that is because Z-Man Games has just released Kings and Things. That's another Tom Wham game.
Yeah.
And it's a bit of a reworking. And that's why I'm thinking that the Awful Green Things is going to be kind of like a reworking of it. But I don't remember it coming out from Steve Jackson Games. Maybe one of our listeners can point me in the right direction.
Yeah.
I just seem to recall it was always TSR. And I remember back in the day when we saw some people playing it, we were kind of like, what?
What?
We're like,
this wacky two-player game.
Too silly.
Now, Give Me the Brain by James Ernst. All the players are zombies. See, the zombies are back. Shuffling and moaning through their horrible jobs. And whoever gets rid of all his jobs first will win. Every turn, you can do a couple of things. And if you're sneaky, you can also push a job or two onto the other players. The big catch is some jobs actually require a brain, and there's only one in the whole restaurant, and the zombies keep dropping it. So that one is out right now. You can actually go order it. Give Me the Brain.
Give Me the Brain.
Lord of the Fries is, welcome to Friedley's, the fast food restaurant of the damned. The whole staff is dead, and we're really short on brains, but we'll do our best to fill your order. Even a horde of nearly mindless zombies can assemble combo meals. Sort of. Combine frighteningly generic ingredients like cow meat, sauce, and drink.
To make
play
brains?
From eight different menus. Brains! Play from eight different menus. Build orders like bovine spongy form. Bovine spongy form. Penne for your tots. Synaptic relay deteriorator and sheep with the fishes. But be quick, the customer's waiting. Whoever fills the best orders get the most points. And zombie with the most points becomes the Lord of the Fries. So a zombie restaurant game. Interesting. So those are the new games coming out from Steve, re-releasing from Steve Jackson. Lord of the Fries, Awful Green Things isn't out yet, but you can already get Give Me the Brain.
I have just a few words for Steve Jackson. So if anyone out there knows Steve Jackson, point him in the direction to listen to this podcast. Steve, do us all a favor. Quit focusing on zombie dice, Lord of the Fries, things like that, and bring Car Wars into the 21st century. You are sitting on a gold mine, and you're worried about zombie dice.
You know, I would like to play a nice little streamlined Car Wars, you know? We had a lot of fun playing Car Wars.
I'll tell you what's going to happen. Eventually, somebody is going to do a reworking of Car Wars. But it's not going to be Car Wars. Because you can get away with creating a vehicular combat game a la Road Rally from Z-Man Games.
Yeah.
And creating it where it's going to be streamlined, you're going to have the feeling of actual movement of the vehicles while you're playing. And they're going to release that, and it's going to be a hit. It's not going to be, you know, we're not talking about huge Dominion kind of numbers, things like that. But it is going to be a big seller, and Steve Jackson is going to be sitting there scratching his head or some other location, wondering, why in the world didn't I just go back to what built the company, which that is the game that built the company, Car Wars.
There was a lot of good Car Wars stuff.
Yeah. I'm not saying that, you know, go back to the days of where every few months there was another Uncle L's update to, you know, the catalog of things that you could do. If Steve Jackson took the mindset of, let's say, Fantasy Flight Games with Arkham Horror, just redesign the game where it could be played in a smaller area, a little faster playing rules, a little faster playing combat, and decided to periodically, maybe every 6 months, release a new expansion that brought something like 18-wheelers and vans, like
right.
Truck Wars, if I remember right, or Truck Stop. I'm sorry, that was Truck Stop came out and that introduced. He could just sit back and print money. He really
think so,
could.
Eh? I would really honestly love to see a modern version of this game, to tell you the truth. I'd like to see mounted boards that are interchangeable so you can build your own tracks rather than, you know, all the boards were paper.
Right.
You know, they're little cardboard stuff.
Well, right? Remember, we would actually, with some of them, they were like cardstock that came out. They were cardstock, but the original game, yeah, they were just paper.
Right. Yeah, it would be so cool to see the 21st century version of Car Wars.
Right.
And you could have campaigns where you build up your characters and they can get better over time. That would be cool.
Well, Russian Crush from AEG. That's another example. The only drawback that I felt to Russian Crush was there were too few vehicles involved in the game. And there weren't enough different accessories. I think there were like 6 different cars and I think 8 different accessories altogether. There were no rules to like build your own vehicle, anything like that.
Yeah.
Because there were people who sat there, including ourselves, and would spend loads of time designing new vehicles.
Yeah, it's true. That was a lot of the fun, was building your car at the beginning, or truck or motorcycles or whatever you had.
Right. I don't know what the issue is with Steve Jackson.
Yeah, I don't know.
My understanding, I don't know him, never met him. I really haven't, you know, read much about him. My understanding is he'll kind of get on a kick, and that's where he stays.
A la Munchkin?
And in fact, Knights of the Dinner Table, that comic book.
Yeah.
Gary Jackson is like the big, you know, like game company guru guy with Hackmaster and things like that. He's supposed to be like a mishmash of Gary Gygax and Steve Jackson.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yes, Steve Jackson, enough of the Lord of the Fries. Get to work on Car Wars 21st Century. I will be first in line to buy it, and we will talk about it on every damn show. If it's good.
I'll even pre-order it if they do one of those 500.
Right, exactly.
P500 things.
I'm right with you. I'm right with you. And if it's a lousy game, we'll talk about it on every show just to make fun of it.
Right.
And talk about the lost opportunity.
Look what they've screwed up.
Look what Steve Jackson Games messed up this time.
So
I have some great news. And Elliot, I do want to ask you to make sure that you are sitting down for this. Okay.
I believe I am, actually.
Because I have great news for Discworld fans. There is a Discworld board game being designed by Discworld fans for Discworld fans.
Really?
It's called Guards, and it's well on its way to hitting the shelves this summer. It's going to be published by Z-Man Games here in the U.S., and it's going to be distributed by Esdevium Games in the U.K. and Europe. The game was designed by Leonard Boyd and David Brashaw from Backspindle Games, and we should see it on shop shelves probably in June or July. So it's going to beat Martin Wallace's Tree Frog Games Discworld release by a good 3-4 months.
Nice.
The game sees players taking on the role of newly recruited members of the Ankh-Morpork City Watch. Did I pronounce that right? You're the one who reads the series.
Yeah, I think we went through this last week. But yeah, I'm pretty sure it's Ankh-Morpork.
Okay. So with the 8 great spells missing from the Unseen University, the future of the Disc hangs in the balance. On their quest to save the Disc world, the players are faced with many hazards of everyday life in Ankh-Morpork, the Disc world's oldest, grubbiest, and least law-abiding city. Some perils are thrust upon them by the hand of fate. Others are going to be directed at them by their opponents in the shape of sneaky guild abilities or skulking saboteurs, secretly planted to disrupt their attempts to return the great spells to the Unseen University. You can add to this the constant threat of being trampled by the luggage, an 800-pound magical chest thundering endlessly through the city on hundreds of little legs, and the players will soon learn that life on the Discworld is not always easy. With over 90 character cards illustrated by Discworld artist Stephen Player, each carrying a short quotation defining the character in the author's own words, the players should be quickly immersed in the magical and, as Elliot will abide by, wonderful world created by Terry Pratchett. At the moment, I've been emailing back and forth with Leonard and David to get some exclusive coverage of Guards Guards that we should see shortly on the website.
Sweet. Wow, I had no idea. That's the coolest thing ever.
I told you I had some gaming news that you probably were not aware of that you'd be pretty excited about.
Excellent. Oh, and I love that artwork, too. And they'll have the little quotes for each character. That is going to be sweet.
Yeah, probably a little flavor cards? Text.
Yeah.
90 different characters, yes.
Oh, that'll be excellent. Well, I have no idea how the game will be played, but, you know, I'll definitely give it a try. I'm going to have to start selling off body parts or something so I can afford to all these games that are coming out that I want to get.
Well, we should be receiving some info about some playtesting sessions that have been going on. So we'll have more about how does the game play. You know, what exactly do the players do and how do you win and things like that.
Excellent. Definitely. I'm hoping it's got some good theme. You know, I'm a theme guy.
I know.
Immerse me in a world and I'm good for it.
That's why you can sit there and you can get all excited about Arkham Horror. Like, for an example, when you said this is going to be something completely new for Arkham Horror, I thought you were going to tell me that Fantasy Flight Games was going to release a rule book that you could understand on the first read through.
Oh, it's easy to understand. You just, you know, you need a few degrees and you'll be fine.
You know, I'd have played that game if I had gone to Harvard.
That's all they play at Harvard, you know.
That's right.
At Yale, the Skull and Bones, that's what they play all the time.
Exactly.
Yeah, my last piece of news is also related to Fantasy Flight Games. If you remember, a while back we talked about Android. You know, I had a lot of fun playing the game. It was so all-encompassing and deep in this sci-fi Blade Runner-esque world that they created that it was not easy to actually learn the game. But once you get through it and you learn it, it's got so much involved in it that it was just completely themed you into the game, which I loved. And now they've announced that they're publishing novels from the Android universe. The first novel that's going to come out is called Free Fall. It's set in the world of Android, which is cool because that's one of the things about the game that maybe, you know, I was interested in this world that they had fully fleshed out. Now I'm going to get to actually read some more in-depth about it. You know, they're on this kick now where they're starting to publish novels. They've got the Arkham Horror novel that's coming out. Now they've got an Android novel that's coming out. This is going to be written by William H. Keith. In the future, and while the world has changed, crime has not. When an influential lawyer is brutally murdered at the top of the Beanstalk, a towering exo-atmospheric elevator serving as the Earth's hub of interplanetary trade, Captain of Detectives Rick Harrison reluctantly accepts the case. Harrison's investigation soon leads him from the sprawling megapolis of New Angeles to the distant moon base of Heinlein, where he must search for clues amongst an uncooperative assortment of biodroids, clones, and disgruntled human laborers. So, that's enough to pull me in. I'm at least going to pick it up and read it, see if it's any good. Like I said, I enjoyed Android, so why not?
And it's a very Blade Runner-ish future. Did you notice when you were going through the rules for Android on the first gatefold, you know, when you first open up the rules, they had the photograph of LA from Blade Runner?
Really? No, I didn't notice that.
Yeah, it's from Blade Runner, yeah.
Yeah, it's very Blade Runner-like. I mean,
that's true.
The whole world is, hell, it's New Angeles is the city. Megapolis. Exactly. Looking forward to it. This summer. Good.
I do have a few last short pieces of gaming news before we move on to the reviews. First off, last show we talked about how we'll be at Origins as card-carrying members of the press.
Yay!
We will also be at Gen Con in that same capacity.
Woot!
I've been bouncing around the idea, and I haven't mentioned it to yourself, Elliot, until now, but I was thinking of maybe trying to do something at Origins where, you know, people who like the website, who listen to the show, maybe they can get together with us for, like, pizza or something, one of the evenings of the show.
Do they have pizza in Ohio?
I think they do. I don't know if it's any good, but I'm sure they do have pizza. So I thought that might be kind of interesting, get to meet some of the people who visit the website and listen to the show and, you know, talk to them about games, maybe interview some of them as far as their, you know, favorite games, things like that.
Yeah. Well, so, I'll bring along all my 8x10 photos of me that I can autograph and hand out.
Yeah. Oh, good. Make sure it's the one that the profile shot of you with, you have your hand up to your face, like right, to your chin, as if you're deep in thought.
Like on my Facebook?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Bring that one. In fact, you know what? I'd go 11 by 13 on those.
I might. I'll frame them.
Mm-hmm. Frames are an additional $30. That's an even better idea. We'll get it set up where, just like when you go to like Comic-Con,
right,
or Wizard World.
We'll set up a booth next to Lou Ferrigno.
Exactly. It'll be between Lou Ferrigno and Dirk Benedict.
Yes.
And then we'll charge like $20, and you can take pictures with Elliot for like another, I don't know, $10. We'll have frames. Yeah, I think that would be a great way for us to make some additional cash. Hey, we could make it like our Essen fund.
Sweet. Buy a picture, send us to Essen.
And
I'll be all crotchety when I sign stuff. Here.
Right. Yeah.
Name.
Yeah. Don't bother me. And you'll just write something like, "Don't you know who I am? Elliot Miller." "Don't you realize who I am? Elliot Miller."
I'll have to hire somebody who actually will slide the picture over to me and then slide it back to the person when I'm done.
So that, right, I won't, so your hands can't contact. Touch.
Yes.
Yes, exactly. I like that idea. I think that'll be good. A bit of news that is maybe not so happy. Our very own Gamer on the Plains, James Englehart, is no longer going to be contributing to the show or to the website. Hopefully it's not anything completely final. I'd love to have him still contribute time to time. But he did inform me that because of changes in his career, that he really isn't going to have much time to do any writing. He probably won't even have much time to do any gaming. So I would find that very hard to believe, knowing James like we do. I'm sure he'll be able to try to squeeze some gaming in. But yes, we are very sad to announce that it's, for right now, it's Elliot and myself. And we do have a couple of contributors from New Zealand. Sam and Andrew are going to contribute to the Gaming Gang, but probably only on maybe a monthly basis. And we will see some pieces from them within the next few days on the website.
That's cool.
But for the most part, it is Mr. Miller and myself.
Dun-dun.
Dun-dun.
We will miss you, James.
Yes, definitely. We definitely will. I believe that brings to a close our gaming news. On the last show, we introduced a new segment that we called The Game Plan. And we had our friend Alan Emmerich from Victory Point Games as our first guest. Because of some of the conventions that are going on this weekend, PresCon is the first one, and Virginia is the first one that pops into my head. We don't have anybody for the segment for this show. But on our next program, we're going to be joined by Grant Dahlgrish from Columbia Games. So I think that'll be pretty fun.
Nice. That's cool.
Yeah, very cool. We're lining up a lot of different guests. We know we're going to get to talk to a lot of these people. I mean, I will at ConSim World here in Arizona, but we're going to talk to quite a few of them also at Origins and Gen Con. But we don't want to wait until then.
Yeah,
I agree. you know, those are months down the line. We want to talk to these people now and share some of their thoughts with you. Grant will be joining us on the next episode, so look forward to that.
Excellent.
Excellent.
Another new segment we're going to be introducing is called Quick Hits, which is our first impressions of a game. We haven't gotten to play the game enough to give a full review of it yet, but we've played it a little bit and we got our basic impressions of the game from our initial standpoint.
And we've seen the box cover.
Right. That's all we need, really.
Because remember, right. Because as we mentioned in the last show, that's how we're now going to review games, because we're such experts, we can tell by looking at the box.
Yes. Okay. First, we'll mention Lucardo. It's a card game by Leo Marshall. It involves building compound phrases or compound words out of a deck of cards that have different words on them. Like a card mm-hmm. could have in, and then another card could have... something else that goes with in.
In trouble?
That sounds good. Is that really a compound word?
No. No, that is not what... Yeah, that's not a compound word.
How about this? How about you could have out and then side, and you get outside. You build a little grid in front of you, and all of the cards have to match up within this grid so that whichever direction you read from, it makes compound words. Kind of like how a crossword puzzle Correct. Goes. So, it's a... For me, it was...
Like a crossword puzzle?
Well, you know how it goes up and down and sideways and, you know,
right.
you build
yes,
this
exactly.
chain
yes.
of words, compound words that actually make sense. And they have to be real words, you know?
Of course.
So people, I guess, get to vote on them. And it's an interesting game.
I have to get more plays in before I can review it. But yes, you're pretty much on the money as far as that goes. You are putting together compound words and scoring. It plays pretty quickly. It is a self-published game, and the quality of the cards and everything is pretty decent, better than a lot of stuff that's been sent to us that's been self-published. But we will probably have a full review of Lucardo, maybe on our next show is what I would think. I have been trying out TC Tennis from Victory Point Games. It is designed by Terry Coleman. Came out within about the last month or so, and I had talked about it a little bit previously, a little bit of a, kind of a sneak peek. I have gotten some games in. It's only male tennis players that are included right now in the game. Women tennis players are going to be in an expansion, no doubt. There's obviously an expansion involved because there's mention of it in the rules itself.
Yeah.
A lot of strategy involved. Each tennis player, and yes, John McEnroe is included in the game.
I knew he had to be there.
There is a lot of strategy involved. Each player is rated like forehand, serve, things like that. You can pretty much put together some tournaments where the underdog can win. Each match isn't necessarily, oh, God, big Bill Tilden from the 1920s and 30s playing against Roger Federer. Bill's got no chance of winning. That's not necessarily the case. Pretty interesting. There are a few things that I've kind of been stuck on. I'm sure I'm just misunderstanding the rules. So I want to kind of clear those up with a few more plays before I get into too much detail and do a review. Something else I'm involved with is a playtest for Victory Point Games. It's a Chris Taylor design that's coming out. There's a little bit of info on Victory Point Games' website, so I can mention the game. It's Legions of Darkness, and I'll be the first one to point out I'm probably a terrible playtester.
Probably a terrible gamer, but you know.
Well, you know that. You've played with me. I'm Mr.
What
Sulky.
I lost.
I'm not playing anymore.
Throw the card game
I don't like
the room.
Anybody. Yeah, tear the cards in half. Enough of this
nonsense.
What do
you mean terrible playtester?
Well, it's funny. I've gotten to play the game, and it's pretty cool. And of course, you know, it's still in playtesting, so you don't give any kind of final verdict there. But every time I'm playing it, and I come up with something, and of course, it's a solo game. It's going to be a States of Siege release, every time I kind of come up with something and I think, oh, hey, you know, this is something I really should point out, I'll go and I'll bring up my email. And then there's other people who are writing in and they've already talked about it.
Ah.
And I'm like, crap. Okay. What am I going to do? Email and say, hey, yeah, you know, Mike, he's on the money there.
These corners aren't rounded properly on the cards.
Yeah, that's
really
right.
Bothering me.
I believe I did check the corners, and the corners are only 89 degrees. I'm a little upset by that. It's shaping up to be a very cool game, fantasy setting. So that's something I know you're a big
fantasy
fan
fantasy horror
of,
setting?
Elliot. No, not fantasy horror, fantasy.
Okay. Well, I mean from the title.
You're holding out against mobs of orcs and goblins or the undead. There's two different opponents that you can play against. And there's a lot going on. It's like any victory point game that we've run across. There's a lot under the hood.
Yeah. See, I would have called it Armies of Darkness and based it on, the movie.
Yeah, I was going to say, and then you have to worry about somebody coming along and saying, that's kind of sort of like, copyright infringement.
Yeah, copyright, schmoppyright. Did you see the new Mickey Mouse t-shirts I'm selling on the website?
Mortimer the Rat. You're getting all this stuff made in China too, right?
Well, I have to. That's not ridiculous.
You're going to include it with your Gucci shoes? Just so everyone knows, sorry, we're going off on a quick little tangent. I do recall one time years ago, Elliot and I were going out. I think we were going out for beers or something. And you show up and you're like, hey, check out my new watch. And I was like, oh, yeah. And you're like, yeah, it's a Rolex. And you were showing me it. And I'm like, get out of here, man. That is not a Rolex. Even though it had the little thing inside that said Rolex. And he's like, do you remember this? You're like, no, man, this is a Rolex. I bought it off this guy. Blah, blah, blah. Oh, man. you were working downtown, and anyone who works in downtown Chicago and has to walk the streets of downtown Chicago on their way to their transportation to and from work will be accosted almost on a daily basis by people trying to sell them things, gold chains, so forth, whatever. Right. In fact, we used to have a joke because we were downtown one time. I don't know if you remember this. And this really weird kind of creepy guy kind of came up to us and he's like, you guys want to buy some watches? And that's how he spoke. Do you want to buy some watches? He's like, I've got watches here. And he pulled up the sleeve of his coat and he had like all these watches on his arm. I've got nice watches. Do you need to buy a watch? So Elliot's showing me this watch, and he's like, no, man, it's a Rolex. It really is. It's a Rolex. And I'm like, there is no way that you got a Rolex. By the end of the evening, the little Rolex,
insignia?
What? Insignia, yeah. Thank you. The little Rolex insignia inside had broken loose, and it was actually kind of like rolling around inside the watch face.
Oh, my gosh. I don't remember this at all.
Yep, I remember this.
Slightly.
Probably, I don't know, 20 years ago? No, maybe. Yeah, about 20 years ago.
It was a Rolex, man.
It was a Rolex.
I believe it. The piece broke off and it said Molex underneath.
Yeah, right. And I remember you took it off your hand, your wrist, I should say, and threw it in the trash.
Right. My arm was all green already.
Right. And it was, you were like, yeah, I bought it from this guy. It was like 10 bucks, blah, blah, blah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Rolex, huh?
So I got a chance to play Nightfall for the first time.
AEG.
AEG, designed by David Gregg. It's my first time that I've played it, so I need to play at least a few more times before we can do some kind of review. Our first game took like 3 hours. Which I believe is atypical for the game.
Yes, very atypical.
And it's very interesting, and the kind of strategies that you have to build are different than the other deck-building type games that I've played. So they didn't start hitting me till, hour two started. So after that, it started to kind of click. And I'm like, oh, see, you need to do this. And it's one of those games where you really should be familiar with the cards that are on the table that you can choose from to purchase.
Right.
Because it's...
You have a draft mechanic to begin the game where the first player gets to see the cards and they pick the one that they want, and then that gets handed to the player to their left and they pick one. And people who probably play Magic the Gathering tournaments, closed deck, is that it? Closed deck tournament?
Oh, maybe. They're like, I think they're draft tournaments.
I don't know. Maybe that's what they call them, draft tournaments. It's been years since we played Magic, so.
And I do like that there's that mechanic in there. And you end up with two little decks that you can purchase from, and you're the only one who can purchase from them. And I thought that was kind of a neat thing to add on there. The chain thing, there's this where you, to get your cards out into play, you have to play them in a chain, and then other people can play them on your chain based on the little colors. So if you're colorblind, you know, you're out of luck. It was kind of neat, and everybody started catching on after a while that, okay, you want to get your cards out at these cards out at this point, so you want to play them in a chain, and they have little kicker things, and if you can get a certain combo out in a chain, then you get this special kicker thing that happens, which is usually a bonus for you. And so it's got a lot of that neat stuff in there, but all your minions disappear at the end of your attack, and that bugged a lot of people. You go to this trouble to get your minions out, they attack once and they're gone. They're back in your...
They're gone, right.
And all your starting cards that you start with, once they're gone, they're out of the deck. So you got to hurry up and buy some cards to add to your deck. Otherwise, you're going to run out of cards. So overall, I got to get a few more plays in. In the beginning, it was a little tough. I had some rules questions, although I do like the rulebook a lot. They got a lot of little extra stories in there about the world of Nightfall, and that's kind of neat. And the rules aren't that difficult, but there's some clarifications I want to get to make sure I'm doing it right.
That's something that popped into my head as I was giving it a try. From my experience here, I think the chain system took a little getting used to for some people. They weren't used to that aspect.
That's a whole new thing.
You mentioned the rule book with the additional story, backstory, and things like that. I have to be very honest. I don't need all that backstory. Lay the rules out a little bit better.
Gotcha.
You know?
Yeah.
The rule book wasn't as badly presented as Thunderstone Dragonspire by any stretch. But still, there is some confusion. And I would think that the 2-3 pages, because there's like two stories in the rules.
Yeah, there is. At the beginning and at the end.
Right. I would rather have them just take the story from the end and devote those 2 or 3 pages that it came out to a little more clarification on the rules.
Yeah, because some of the cards do make some questions come up. So
yes.
And the whole chain thing, that tended to slow the game down because, you know, that it can change. Like, the first person lays it down so the next person can play either yellow or silver. Well, if they put down a card, then the cards change. So the person next in line has to look through their cards real quick and decide, see if they have a card that they can play on the chain. So slow the game down a little bit while you waited for everyone to decide to figure out if they can play their next card or not. That's why I want to play it more, because I'm sure once you get used to that, it's going to go a lot quicker.
Our first game certainly didn't last 3 hours. It was probably more along the lines of about an hour and a half, maybe a little more than that. But still, the game is not designed to last that long.
Well,
so you should be able to get a game in about 30 to 45 minutes.
Yeah, and I'm sure with a little more playing, you know, this was our first play.
Oh, of course. Well, that's why we're not doing a review. We're just kind of talking about our first impressions of what we've run across.
And now it's time for the Gaming Gang's game review. Try saying that 10 times fast.
I'm not going to try.
First up is Chaos Isle and its expansions from Realm Masters Game Forge. If you took Chaos Isle at face value, if you just took a look at the game itself, laid out the components, laid out the cards, which is effectively all the components, and just looked at the art, things like that, you probably would sit there going, not for me. Simply because a lot of the art's very amateurish. And then on the flip side, some of the art is really good.
Yeah, you know, I had the same thought. When I was playing it with Becky, she's in art school, you know, and she starts talking about the different art on the cards, and some of them were really good, and I really like it. Especially the cards that have that, like, two-tone monochrome look to them. Those had some really good art.
A lot of the cards...
But some of them didn't.
If you would notice, it's the monster cards.
Yeah.
And I believe that artwork is by Swedish illustrator Christer Degerman. And the monsters can be really creepy looking. And, you know, it brings a lot of flavor to the game. And then when you look at the character cards that each player is representing and some of the equipment, and it's sort of like...
It's Munchkin-esque.
No, it's worse than that. It is. Let's be honest here. Some of the artwork for the characters, we're talking intensely bad. That kind of threw me off a little bit when I was first looking through. And the graphic design is a little strange, too, because if you notice the cards, because you have four different kinds of cards, missions, characters, equipment, and enemies, which are the zombies. The whole point of the game is that you're trapped on this island that this mad scientist was experimenting and created these zombie creatures. They're not your typical human zombies. Many of them are, but some of them are just wild, crazy creatures. If you look at the backs of the cards, it's kind of difficult to tell the cards apart. What are the character cards? What are the mission cards? What are the equipment cards? That throws you off a little bit. Now, granted, there is a different color. I know there aren't a lot of people out there who are colorblind. And take those people who are colorblind and then take the percentage of them who are gamers and then it shrinks it even more. But still, it would be a little bit of a difficult time sorting through these things. I understand this is a small company. This is really their only game. They probably put together the game on a very, very small budget. So we do understand that.
Well, I don't know. The back of the card says enemy, equipment, character, mission.
I know.
So it's got text on it.
Yeah, right. I understand that. I'm talking about when you're looking at it, not holding the card in front of your face, but putting the card down on the table. People were having to kind of lean over and go, okay, which ones are the what cards?
Right, okay.
That's something that I kind of take into consideration when I'm playing a game. I had mentioned this with Commands and Colors Napoleonics, that some of the images on the blocks, if you're holding it in front of you and you're looking at it, yeah, of course. Yeah, I see the difference between it. But when you're sitting there at the table and you've got the pieces on the board, it's the distance you're kind of going, And that's what I'm mentioning here. I know it sounds like we're going in a very negative direction with the game, talking about the artwork and the design decisions, but that's far from the point. I mean, we can move beyond these things, but we do want to point them out because in the end, Chaos Isle is a lot of fun.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun playing it. I mean, it's a light horror game where you fight zombies.
It's pretty funny, too, because the characters themselves aren't necessarily people that you would want to represent in a game. You're kind of like, okay, well, they were actually a lunatic killer before this apocalypse took place. Okay.
I do like the little description text they have for the characters. I mean, we did make a point to sit there and read the different descriptions for each one.
Oh, sure, because they are pretty funny.
Yep, they definitely are.
I enjoy the game for a few different reasons. Number one, everybody's going to have a different goal. Not every single player is trying to do the same exact thing. Some people need to collect different resources for many of the missions that you have. And whoever completes their mission, well, staying alive, is the winner. Everybody has different missions. And as you add in the different expansions, there's four expansions that are building on the game. There's usually new missions in the expansions. There's new creatures. There's new ways to play the game. One survivor might be trying to create a bomb that's going to destroy the zombies. Somebody else might be trying to find the cure. The mission card, and it's random, is going to tell you what you're going to try to do. And it's pretty much normally a matter of just collecting the resources.
It adds a bit of depth to the game where you're not just playing and foof. You kill the zombies and it's over. Although they do have different game styles of play.
That's something else, yes, I was going to mention as well. And each expansion throws at least one new wrinkle in as far as how you're going to play it. There's a survivor mode, there's team play, solo rules, ultimate big game hunting, zombie cage match. There's a lot of different things. So once you've played it enough times, you can switch it up and you get to try something new. I know a lot of people, the game's not going to be their cup of tea simply because there's loads and loads of luck involved in the game. in the combat, each turn, each player is going to draw three cards, three enemy cards, and then you can decide which of those you're going to try to kill, which of them you're going to try to avoid. Every character is rated for speed, so if their speed is higher than the speed of the enemies that they've taken, they can decide that they don't want to fight them and just discard them. That's not going to get you resources, though, because you have to kill these creatures to get the resources. Every turn, you're usually fighting, and you've got different equipment to make different attacks and things like that. I know a lot of people don't like a lot of luck in their games. They want everything to be, well, you know, I made this move, and I'm planning 3 hours down the line, and blah, blah, blah. They won't dig this, because you are going to roll loads and loads of dice.
It's almost completely luck-based, yeah.
All the time. Because it's pretty, even for the theme, it's pretty lighthearted, it's pretty funny. You do have some options to screw over your fellow players as well. It's a load of fun.
I like the fact that they've got the little event cards that come out and things happen when the event comes out. They've got tasks that you can attempt if you want to give yourself an extra piece of equipment. There's a lot of fun there.
It is, and it's a fast game. You can usually get through a game, depending on how many people are playing, you can blast through a game in about 15 minutes, maybe 20 minutes too. It's a good game to break out when you're waiting for your other friends to show up, or towards the end of the night. You don't want to play anything too heavy or something that's going to last a long time. And it's not expensive. I think right now, and I'm sure I'm wrong, but I believe right now you can pick up Chaos Isle with the four expansions for probably about $35.
Yeah, I have no idea.
If I remember correctly, that's about what it's running. It might be a little bit less than that. I sort of look at Chaos Isle as one of those guilty pleasures.
Yeah.
Everybody has their favorite B movies that most people would kind of look down their nose at and be like, oh, you really enjoyed Reanimator or Army of Darkness? And you're like, yeah, man, that movie's great. That movie rocks. Chaos Isle, I kind of look at it the same way.
You know, one thing I like about it is the fact that if you get killed, because your character can't get killed, you actually become the zombie that killed you. And for the rest of the game, you get to attack the other players on your turn and try to kill them off and make them into zombies, which I thought was pretty cool. A nice little addition to keep the players in the game even after they're dead. But the only thing that bugged me is the rules weren't as complete as I needed. You know, it's that one page double-sided, and there was some stuff missing for me. Like, what happens to your zombie if he gets killed? We wanted to keep the players in the game the whole game, so we played it where the zombie just, you know, retreats. And then the character who he attacked gets to go on and finish what they're doing. But it doesn't say in the rules what happened. So, and there were a couple other things.
I understand.
Yeah, we kind of had to make up our own rules. I haven't gone and looked up. Yeah, I'm sure there's some FAQs out there that I could find.
Which leads me to something a little off topic, talking about FAQs. I have an issue with that. I really do. I'm not picking on Chaos Isle, because you and I talked before we started the show, and we were talking about the combat. I was talking about, well, no, this is how we were playing it. And you said, well, no, this is how we were playing it. And then you said, well, you know, I didn't see anything in the rules. And I was mentioning, well, it's here. And you were like, oh, yeah, you're right. If you can't put together rules that make sense in the first place, there is an issue. I don't expect a designer or game company, to be able to predict every single situation that could possibly come up in a game. I don't expect that. But when you have very, very basic concepts of the game that are not correctly explained in the rules, you've got a problem. Because not every place that you go are you going to have access to go online. Oh, hey, you know, we have a question about what happens in phase 4 if XYZ happens. Well, we'll just jump online and take a look. Right. A lot of times you don't have that
capability. Though I have to tell you, I have not played a game in recent memory that we didn't have some kind of questions come up that needed some further clarification. That's completely out of the box.
Unfortunately,
everything's there and every possible question that can come up can be answered. I don't know.
And like I said, I don't expect that. But when you're playing a game and there is something that is going to come up time and time again, and it's not properly presented, I have a serious issue with that. To me, that's just lazy design, terrible editing, and not enough playtesting.
I think it makes a big difference, too, playtesting, for the people who are trying to release this game to actually be in the room with the people who are playtesting the game so they can see where the stumbling blocks occur and the questions that come up. Playtesting remotely is all right, but you're not going to get to see that actual stumbling block occur. You're only going to get it if somebody looks for something and then they can't find it, and then they're like, oh, wait, here it is. They eventually found it. Well, maybe it wasn't obvious enough in the rules for them to spot it right off, so they had to go back and search. Well, those are all little stumbling blocks where you got to go back and search for stuff. So maybe we should include some player aid or player card that summarizes that stuff for them. Yeah, I had the same trouble playing when I played Civilization. There was some stuff that we had to look up, you know, Fantasy Flight. We're getting better at the rules, but, you know.
Right. Still not where we would like them to be.
But
I think part of the problem, and a lot of it does stem from playtesting, I think part of the problem is that many of these companies out there, many of these designers, the playtesting is done by their pals, their friends. And a lot of times you're not going to be as critical about something, and it's human nature. You're not going to be as critical about something knowing that it's a buddy of yours, a close friend of yours, who has put their blood, sweat, and tears into something than if it's just complete strangers. You know, I'm not saying that every single friend who playtests isn't going to be critical or, you know, sit down and say, hey, you know, okay, this is what we ran across here. We had questions about this, so forth and so on. But I think companies are better served by playtesting with complete strangers than with people who are already in-house or associated. The only problem there is then if you're going to let complete strangers playtest, then you have a problem with people releasing information about the game ahead of schedule. Let's say, for an example, you're playtesting a design and there is this particular piece of that design that's broken. Now, you will no doubt address that, I would hope. But if you have unknown entities playtesting, you have to be careful because they could release it saying, hey, you know, I've been playing such and such game. It's coming out, whatever. And this part of it really sucks and, you know, blah, blah, blah. All of a sudden, now you're looking at, you've got this negative idea or impression floating around out there. People are going to jump on that and that's going to hurt your sales in the end. So I see both sides of the coin, but I do think that the big problems that we have right now with rules is not enough playtesting or ineffective playtesting and poor editors. I'm not talking about Chaos Isle. I made sense out of it.
I mean, like I said, it's a light enough game. When we got confused, we just decided how we wanted it to be, you know, and kept on trucking.
And now that we talked about it, like I said, when we talked earlier before the show, you're like, oh, yeah, now, okay, yeah, that does make sense.
That is actually going to make the game easier. Because I missed a little rule that says you can escape the monsters if your speed is higher. So we were fighting every monster. So our first game, two of the players got killed. One of them got killed on his second turn.
Right.
So it was still fun.
And it happens. We all misread rules. First time I played, well, first two times I played Cargo Noir, I misunderstood the gold coins at the end of the game. And until I realized that I had made that mistake in those rules, my opinion of the game was very low.
Ah, yeah. See, one little thing can change it a lot.
You know, I was like, well, yeah, I've played this twice, and I must be missing something because I just don't see what the whole point of the entire game up until the end would be if these gold coins are worth. I thought they were worth 10 cargo points as opposed to one cargo point at the end of the game. So I was like, well, why wouldn't you just sit there collecting gold coins until there aren't any gold coins left to hand out in the bank? I learned my mistake, played it quite a few more times, and was like, okay, yes, I enjoy the game quite a bit more now. And I'm glad I didn't write a review based on playing something twice. I guess to sum it up, Chaos Isle is a fun game.
Yes, it's a fun game. Very light. Fun game.
It may not be for the Euro snob because you're throwing, you know, a bunch of dice around, But I would think for most gamers out there, they're going to get a kick out of it. They're going to enjoy it. And after a few plays, the artwork, you know, those issues kind of go away, or you just don't notice it anymore because you're having such a good time with the game. If it was a lousy game, you'd probably be sitting there going, oh, that's enough of that because this game's crap and I'm tired of looking at this art. I know you wanted to discuss a game that's a bit heavier. In fact, with our three reviews, we're going to go light, middleweight, and heavy, heavyweight.
So, and there is quite a bit involved here.
And you're going to be reviewing the box for Sid Meier's Civilization.
I wasn't worried about the stuff inside.
Exactly.
The box was very lightweight when I took everything out of it. I'm going to be talking about Sid Meier's Civilization, the board game, which was designed by Kevin Wilson, came out in 2010. Opening the box for Sid Meier's Civilization, the board game. And it is Sid Meier's Civilization, the board game.
Not to be confused with Civilization.
Right, exactly. It gives you that great feeling you're getting your money's worth. The box is full of cards and tiles and maps and figures and dials and tokens. But when you pull out the rule book, you realize it isn't going to be one of those games you can learn in 20 minutes. The book's 32 pages. It's full color. It's got a lot of diagrams and illustrations. Like I said, it still left me with some questions when the actual gameplay commenced. They're getting better. They're getting there. And I'll admit, I'm biased. I've got...
I know you
I have a long history with the PC versions of Sid Meier's Civilization.
Yeah. Which most
which
of us should.
I was either going to really like this game or hate the game completely. Now, this isn't a board game version of the concept of Civilization. This is really a translation of the PC game to a board game. And I'm sure it's not an easy way to develop a game. It's much simpler to go the other way and make the board game into an electronic version. So the odds of Fantasy Flight being able to capture all the aspects of the computer game were pretty slim. But I think they pulled it off. I'll tell you straight out that if you have experience with the computer game, you'll find it a lot easier to learn how to play the board game. There are so many options and paths that you can follow that it can be somewhat overwhelming to new players with no Civ background. Those who tend to suffer from analysis paralysis will have a difficult time with this game and actually probably should avoid it. Personally, I recommend playing a practice game by yourself before trying to teach it to new players. Actually, I recommend that with a lot of games.
Wouldn't you say, though, that people who have analysis paralysis, there probably are many, many games that you would tell them to take
probably,
a pass on?
Well, probably, but there are games where that doesn't occur. You cater the game to the types of players that you're playing with. And if you're playing with a regular group, you get an idea of who is going to slow up what certain games.
But there are people out there who, it doesn't matter if you were playing blackjack, they're going to sit there and try to analyze every single aspect. You could call them Mr. or Mrs. Downtime.
Right. Well, there's some people that have chronic analysis paralysis. Yes, I'm sure.
And that's what
but
I'm talking about.
In this
about,
game,
right?
This is not one of the games that helps to mitigate it. This is one of those games where you have so many options on your turn, it would extend a player's natural analysis paralysis. Game setup is actually a pretty involved process and can take up to a half an hour by itself. More on your first game. So I recommend setting up the game as much as you can before your fellow players show up. The game's a good 3 hours long already, so setting up in advance makes a lot of sense. The game comes with six civilizations that you choose from, and each has their own unique abilities. You've got the Americans, you've got the Egyptians. They each also have their own personal starting map tile with 16 spaces on it, where the player can build their first city. The rulebook shows you how to lay out the additional map pieces because all the map pieces are various tiles that have 16 spaces on them, and the map changes from game to game. These map tiles are placed face down, so you have to explore the world in order to reveal all the map tiles and see what's happening out there in the world, what you can get. And that's straight out of the PC game, and I love that aspect.
In the PC game, until you run across, like, a barbarian.
Right.
Oh,
and they have
no.
Barbarian camps in here, but they don't happen where you just happen to wander into it and they kill you. You have to make the decision
right.
To actually go into
yes.
it.
Yes. There goes those
scouts. You place
your
capital city token on your home map tile, and the 8 map spaces around it are considered to be part of your city. Each of these spaces can contain various icons representing different resources you can use, including trade, culture, production, and natural resources. The object of the game is to build the best civilization. And there's 4 different ways you can actually win the game. There's a cultural victory. In the board game, culture is measured on this culture track on this separate market board that comes with it. So it also has a separate fold-out board in addition to all the map tiles, which holds most of the items that you can purchase in the game. You collect culture tokens from the squares around your city and spend these to advance along this culture track. And each time you move along the track, you can either draw a culture card, which gives you a special action, or gain a great person who can benefit your civilization. If you're first to reach the end of the culture track, you win the game. But there's also the technological victory. Each player has a stack of technology cards ranging from level 1 to level 4, and you can research technologies which benefit your civilization and allow you to do special actions, build improvements for your cities, and upgrade your military units. Technology is built in a pyramid form, with the lower level 1 techs on the bottom and the level 4 techs at the top. You have to build from the bottom up, so you have to build 2 level 1 techs before you can add a level 2 on top of it. You use your trade resources that you keep track of on the trade dial on your setup card to gain different technologies. Now, there's only 1 level 5 technology in the game, and that's spaceflight. If you're the first player to successfully research spaceflight, and you will have already needed to build your pyramid with 14 other technologies to do it, you win the game.
Now, when you're talking about the pyramid, are you talking about, like you said, you have to have 2 level 1 to get a level 2? Do you have to have 4 level 1 to get 2 level 2s?
Well, let me think of a pyramid. No, you could do it with 3, because you have 3 on the bottom, and then 2 of them could stack up on top of that in a pyramid form.
Okay, I was just kind of curious. I haven't played the game, so that's why.
You can also have an economic victory. Your Civ setup card also has a second dial on it to keep track of coins that you accumulate during the game. Coins are basically the measure of the level of your economy and not things that you actually spend. They're hard to come by, but once you gain them from certain technologies, as well as from certain spots on the map, when you get to 15 coins, you win the game. And of course, finally, there's the military victory. Now, military is represented by armies that you place and move around on the map. And the armies themselves contain units, either infantry, artillery, mounted, or aircraft. The units are on special cards, and they can be upgraded when you research the right technology. You can obtain a military victory by capturing one of the other players' capital cities, and that which is not easy. It's pretty tough. The game is turn-based, and each turn has several phases, where the start of your turn, where you build new cities, and you can also change your form of government, because you have different forms of government you can be, too. There's the trade phase, where you collect your trade icons, and you can also trade with other players. There's the city management phase, where you can perform one action per city, including building new armies or units, adding a building, building a great wonder, collect culture for your city, or you can harvest a special resource. Then there's a movement phase where you can move your armies and your scouts around. And then finally, there's the research phase where you learn new technologies. Yes. All of the pieces blend together to really give you the feeling of building a civilization. And there's so many different strategies to pursue that the game leaves you wanting to come back for more. Again, it's a longer game and it takes some time to master the rules, although the concepts are a lot easier if you know the PC game. It will definitely lead to those who are prone to analysis paralysis to make it last longer. And the other thing is the max players is 4. I would have been happier if it went up to 5. I bet that the very first expansion will add another player to the game. So if those things don't bother you, then I highly recommend this game. I really enjoyed playing it. I haven't even explored all the possible strategies yet, so I'm waiting to try the different types of victories to see how easy or how difficult it is. I'm already thinking about how I'm going to play the next time I play it.
Which is usually the mark of a good game, as opposed to, thank goodness that's over.
So last week we celebrated President's Day here in the U.S., and as we have often asked ourselves while playing games, were we to stand in their shoes, what would George Washington do? Or what would Abraham Lincoln do?
I actually have a little wristband that is WWAL.
Well, if they were around today and wanted to learn more about the fantastic hobby of gaming, these great American wartime presidents would start with a battle lesson game from Victory Point Games.
They would?
Yes.
Hey, you know what? That reminds me. This chapter of the War Room is brought to you by the little game company that could. Our proud sponsors at Victory Point Games. There are 8 different battle lesson games available, and each is designed as a fun experience for veteran wargamers, as well as a perfect introduction for beginners. They're budget priced in the $10 to $15 range, and battle lesson titles range from the Jim Dunnigan Strike Force 1 to legendary designer Frank Chadwick's Battle for Moscow, and include some great solitaire wargames like Darren Leveloff's Israeli Independence, and Chris Taylor's toe-to-toe nuclear combat with the Ruskies. All of these games include an actual lesson to improve your play or teach you how to create your own war games, and offer many small expansion kits for those interested in delving further into that subject. These battle lesson games are on sale right now, bundled in chapters at the Victory Point Games website, where the savings are huge and the gameplay's the thing. Why not get out there and enlist a new recruit to our hobby this week?
Oh, and you know what? I just read on their website that they'll soon be releasing 2 more battle lesson games. One of them's a solitaire game on the Alamo called A Blood Red Banner. And the other one is a 2-4 player fantasy themed game called The Battle of 4 Armies. Both of these are from new first-time game designers.
Well, you know, they do release something new every 2 weeks, so those guys are really busy over there at VPG. And they love to work with new designers, too. They'll help you get your first game published. They actually teach new designers the ropes of game publishing at Victory Point Games and try to help them launch their careers designing games.
Yeah, that's cool.
I think that's pretty cool.
So what are we reviewing in the War Room today?
We are going to take a look at GMT's Spanish Civil War. I'm going to preface this review by saying that I was really excited to see this release coming out from GMT. I'm a big fan of GMT. They have loads and loads of great games. They've really been pushing the envelope lately, especially with Dominant Species, and Washington's War was a great game, kind of introductory level in my opinion, but still a really awesome game. And, of course, with Labyrinth, which is certainly my pick for the best game of 2010. To say I was a little bit disappointed in the Spanish Civil War is more probably due to me and my expectations as opposed to the game itself. But I do want to point that out, that I was expecting something a little bit different. Now, the Spanish Civil War is designed by Javier Romero. Of course, the game covers the struggle within Spain itself between 1936 and 1939. The game is made up of 19 turns that cover July 36 to the final battles in 1939 of Catalonia, Valencia, and Madrid. Your units will represent columns, regiments, brigades, and divisions. Air and naval units are handled with support counters that are used during battles. There are some event counters that are also added into the mix that represent historical moments like the death of popular leaders, militia defections, all different things, different unexpected battle results, things along those lines. The game itself is packaged pretty much as we expect from GMT. Great cover. It's got kind of a Spanish Civil War propaganda poster look to it. The map is very nicely displayed. It's the whole Iberian Peninsula with Portugal as well, parts of France and all of Spain. The map's divided into hexes, as you would expect in a traditional war game, and there's all the different towns and cities that you're going to be fighting over. The unit counters are nicely done, easy to read. They use NATO symbols. The Civil War began, and Germany, the fascist countries, Germany and Italy weren't really involved. The Soviets weren't really involved. And as they become more and more engaged in the Civil War itself, you'll see changes to the units themselves. The counters are color-coded that help the player as far as removing some units and replacing them as they upgrade. There were some wonky spots in the rules that I do notice that they have been addressed in a post on Board Game Geek The rules are pretty well written. They're pretty clear, and they do have examples. And there are some illustrations to assist you in setting up the campaign game, as well as the various different scenarios. The rules are, as I mentioned, they're easy to understand, and they're pretty typical of most war games. The sequence of play, pretty easy. Reinforcements, movement, combat, and then supply. Zone of control is very important in the game, and units that represent, like let's say, non-military units, don't have any kind of zone of control except when they're inside of a town or a city. Now, zone of control, for those of you who aren't real familiar with war games, zone of control is normally when you have opposing units moving. If one of your opponent's units move into a hex that is directly around your unit, they have to stop or they suffer certain negative modifiers, things like that. Every hex on the map has to be occupied by troops for you to control it. At the start of the war, the nationalist forces are divided into two zones. And the reason for this is to represent that even though you were on the same side, there was a lot of mistrust, a lot of miscommunication. Everybody had their own agenda, so they don't work very well together. The Republican forces are also separated into two zones as well. And they have other modifiers involved, but once again, there are some limitations. As a war game itself, the Spanish Civil War is a good game. It really is. It's just not what I was kind of expecting from GMT because it's very, very traditional. You can tell that a lot of historical research went into the design of the game, but one of the problems that I had with it, and once again, as I mentioned right at the beginning, this is kind of probably my fault as opposed to an issue of the game itself, but I was really expecting something new being brought to the table. When I saw that the Spanish Civil War was coming out, it was right at the time I was in the middle of reading Anthony Beaver. He did an excellent book about the Spanish Civil War. It's called The War for Spain. And there was so much going on politically. Even if you were on the same side, you weren't necessarily on the same side. Because you had, for an example, you had socialists and communists and anarchists all part of the Republican forces, yet they didn't work together very well at all. And there were a lot of mismanagement, things like that. I was disappointed there wasn't enough of that included in the game itself. The game plays more as a traditional war game, and I don't think that fits the Spanish Civil War as well as it would, let's say, the Second World War, which the Spanish Civil War was kind of a staging ground for the Second World War, because a lot of the technology, a lot of the tactics that were used later were field tested in Spain. Overall, is it a good game? Oh yeah, definitely. If you're into that time period, if you want to learn more about that period of history, which unfortunately is really underrepresented in my opinion, and I think part of that is because it was such a politicizing and polarizing event in Spain's history that a lot of the Spanish themselves will not discuss it. They do not like to talk about the Civil War. There were so many atrocities and things like that, which, of course, I wouldn't expect that to be represented in a war game.
Yeah, right.
I would hope not. There was so much animosity and real hatred between the two sides, the two factions, that there's still some pretty open wounds even to this day. So I think that's one of the reasons why we don't read as much about the Spanish Civil War as, no doubt, of course, the Second World War and things like that. A good game in the tradition of GMT's classic war game designs. I just was disappointed that it didn't raise the bar, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But it is certainly worth a purchase. All right. So before we finish, we did have a contest last time out, and it's for a copy of Chaos Isle and all four expansions from Realm Masters Game Forge. And to win, all you had to do was simply leave a comment on the website. I'm ready to announce the winner of the contest.
Drum roll sound effect here.
And the winner of the free game and expansions is Viagra.
I believe they had over 200 comments.
Yes. Yes, it was a close one. It was a very close contest between Viagra and Kim's somebody or other's sex tape. Not Cardassian, somebody I don't think I've ever heard of. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Aren't you glad, folks, that we kill those comments before you get a chance to see them? No, the actual winner is Andrew McPherson or McPherson. I don't have an address or anything like that. It's just simply a comment. So, Andrew, if you're listening to the show, definitely get in contact with me, and we will have a brand new copy of Chaos Isle and all four expansions sent directly to you from Realm Masters Gameforge. So, congratulations. We do have a contest for next time.
Tell me about this contest.
Yes. We're going to do for the first 10 people to leave a comment about the show on iTunes, review us on iTunes, you will receive a full color 11 by 13 photo of
exactly
Elliot
where
Miller.
You're going to go. Signed.
Signed. Well, not even signed. Right. You're just going to get
right
that ink
there.
Stamp. And yeah, or actually you're going to have the photo made where like your signature's already like on the photo. So whatever copies they run off already has that.
Wow.
Oh, gosh, we will probably get hundreds of reviews on iTunes just to score that limited edition.
It is. It'll wipe me out.
Photograph of Elliot Miller.
That's cool.
Just kidding. Actually, we don't have a contest this time around. That is the program for this bye week. Elliot, would you care to take us out?
You've been listening to the Gaming Gang Podcast with Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller. If you'd like to know more about the topics or games we discussed in this episode, please visit our website at www.thegaminggang.com. If you would like to have your opinion heard or have a gaming issue you'd like us to discuss on a future podcast, you can visit the Gaming Gang Guild on BoardGameGeek or call us at 480-779-7365 and leave a message. Our show notes are provided by James Englehart and can be found on our website. If you enjoyed listening to our podcast, please rate us on iTunes. Some of the games discussed on our show were provided to the Gaming Gang in the form of review copies. On behalf of everyone here at the Gaming Gang, thanks for listening.